This is the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The following program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin, and you're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, October 2nd, 2019. This week we'll begin with the cover story, Charles in Charge. Who is Charles Francis? You can know a lot about the man who thinks he'll be Raleigh's next mayor without really understanding him. 1. The end is the beginning. Charles Francis is tired. He's standing outside Noir Bar, a Glenwood Avenue nightclub, in the cold drizzle of early November, a dark figure on a dark street. Inside, dozens of supporters await. He adjusts his suit, gray, perfectly tailored, as it always is. And he walks inside, back stiff, posture perfect, as it always is. He's greeted by bright lights and applause. He smiles, as he always does, his smile tempered by exhaustion. He raises his hand and waves. What I know deep in my heart, and I think what all of you know here, is that we did win tonight, the 54-year-old says in the booming baritone, the courtroom voice trial lawyers spend years perfecting. But Francis hadn't won. He hadn't really come close. A month ago, in October of 2017, Francis had barely prevented incumbent Nancy McFarland from securing a majority. Then, as the city's power brokers rolled their eyes, he called for a runoff. Tonight, McFarland trounced him by 18 points. He's just gotten off the phone with her. What I told her, he said, was, I would most certainly be available going forward, and I look forward to working with you and to working with the new city council and with all of you, to working with anybody else also who wants to do so to make Raleigh a truly great city. His speech goes on for 15 minutes. This, he says, was not his campaign. This was our campaign, and in defeat, there is victory. This election proved you can do different things. You can achieve things that people told you could not do. And God didn't put us on this earth to wait until somebody told us it's our turn. And although we didn't get it done electorally tonight, this time, a woman shouts. For a second, Francis' hard-won composure melts away. This time, that's right, he said. Francis grins. Charles Francis never stopped running. It's better to think of the period between November 7, 2017 and March 13, 2019, the day McFarland announced that she wouldn't seek a fifth term, and Francis announced that he'd try again as an intermission. In his bones, Francis wants to be a mayor. He wants to be a transformational figure for Raleigh and his black community, like Maynard Jackson was in Atlanta. For that to happen, however, he needed a new strategy. In 2017, about two-thirds of his support came from African Americans, much of the rest from white progressives energized in the early urgent days of the anti-Trump resistance. For the first time, McFarland, an independent, had faced a Democratic challenger amid brewing discontent over the city's uneven prosperity. That was good, for 42%. To get to 50, Francis had to broaden his coalition. It wouldn't be enough to win Southeast Raleigh. He needed to attract white voters from outside the Beltline, homeowners worried about rapid growth changing their neighborhoods and clogging their commutes. He seemed to be thinking about that even in his 2017 concession speech, when he name-checked the four city council members who have made skepticism of development their cause belay. David Cox, Steph Mendel, Kay Crowder, and Russ Stephenson, and who, as a block, have dominated the council's agenda the last 2 years. As this year's campaign hit the home stretch, he joined them to champion their signature issue, city intervention in a lawsuit over an RDU Airport Authority quarry lease. And like them, he's offering himself as an outsider, taking on entrenched, well-heeled interests. In France's view, his top rivals are part of an establishment that has run Raleigh for far too long. Carolyn Sullivan, the McFarland-endorsed former Wake County Commissioner, with record-shattering fundraising hauls that have come courtesy of big-shot Democratic donors from outside the city, including a recent event in Manhattan with Hillary Clinton and Marianne Baldwin, the former five-term Raleigh City Council member who's a favorite of the developers in the downtown business set. Francis argues that he's a break from this past, a new direction for a city that needs a new perspective. But who is this man who feels destined to be Raleigh's next mayor? That's not such an easy question to answer. The more you probe, in fact, the more of an enigma Charles Francis becomes. As it turns out, you can know a lot about Francis without really knowing who he is, under the expensive suits and behind the finely calibrated answers that always sound like what you want to hear. While he's publicly aligned with Cox's group on some issues, he's distanced himself on others, signaling, in the candidate questionnaire he sent the Indy, receptiveness to increased density in downtown and along some traffic corridors, with an ethic of inclusiveness, accessory dwelling units, scooters, and whole house short-term rentals, as well as reservations about neighborhood conservation districts. On what he acknowledges is the biggest issues facing Raleigh, housing affordability, it's hard to get a read on Francis's plans. He wants to expand home ownership programs and, as suggested, a property tax freeze for some seniors. Beyond that, his proposals are frustratingly vague. He supports a bond that won't specify an amount. At the same time, he says he wants to keep taxes low. And in 2017, he called the city's last tax hike to fund affordable housing the wrong approach. He talks in generalities about adding staff to cut red tape and boosting tax credit finance housing. He wants you to trust that he knows what he's doing. Despite all of that technocratic mumbo-jumbo, Francis says Baldwin and Sullivan are not dealing with those deeper issues that my campaign is working on because for three generations, my family has been engaged in a struggle to rise. We understand these issues in a way that most candidates, I don't think, do. But there's a through line in Francis's life and projects today that doesn't always match the actions he's taken, the jobs he's accepted, or the positions he's held. Some of these alleged contradictions are detailed in an extensive opposition research document McFarland's campaign compiled but never used in 2017. The Indy has obtained the document, though not from McFarland or any competing campaign, and independently verified the contents referenced in this story. Others, they say, have become apparent during this year's campaign. Francis' stance on the RDU quarry netted him the Sierra Club's endorsement, for instance, but he spent years lobbying for the industrial company Alcoa, whose Baden plant has been accused of polluting the Yadkin River with toxic chemicals. And while Francis says he can leverage his connections to bring about more effective government, he's also lobbied for a pyramid scheme that ended with its CEO and Francis's close friend and law partner convicted of federal crimes. Moreover, although Francis said he's the candidate best positioned to help residents displaced by gentrification, he spent a quarter century as general counsel for the Raleigh Housing Authority, once arguing to the state Supreme Court that RHA tenants should not be allowed to sue over lead-based paint in their homes, even as their own family sold houses and rented our own apartments in Southeast Raleigh. And while some of Francis's supporters see him as the embodiment of Black Raleigh's potential, others say that, after the 2017 election, he vanished from Southeast Raleigh, retreating to his $3 million, 8,000-square-foot Burnhamwood Road mansion. In the harsh glow of a political campaign, it's easy for Francis' enemies to paint him in the world's worst possible light. Some of these allegations he disputes, Others, he says, lack context. Ultimately, like any brilliant complex politician, and Francis is, by any measure, both of those things, Francis is more than the sum of a string of facts. He's at once idealistic and cynical, a man driven by ambition and ego, but also a sense of the greater good, and a sense that Raleigh's greater good is him. Number two, legacy. On a wall in Francis's East North Street law office hangs a black-and-white photo of a stern-faced man with a white handlebar mustache and a 100-yard stare. James Irving was born a slave in Onslow County in 1840. He didn't know freedom until the end of the Civil War. With nothing to his name, he eventually settled in Jones County, where he had a son, Charles Irving Sr., in 1896, the year the U.S. Supreme Court handed down Plessy versus Ferguson. After serving in World War I, Irving settled in Raleigh in 1919 and worked as a mailman for over 30 years, while also writing for the Raleigh Independent, which became the Carolinian. He opened a printing press in 1947 with his daughter, Vivian, who later joined the front lines of the local civil rights movement through the NAACP, helping integrate the League of Women Voters, and spent 3 decades as Wake County Registrar. During elections, Vivian sometimes took her nephew Charles to check on the polling stations. Meanwhile, the Irving Swain Press became a hub of local black political life, hosting a rotation of movers and shakers, including Charles Leitner, Raleigh's first black mayor, and John Winters, his first black city council member. As a child, Francis watched these men circulate through the shop. From a young age, politics coursed through his veins. He also knew loss. His father died of a stroke when he was 9. His grandfather stepped in to raise him. Francis talks about this matter-of-factly. "We kept going," he said. At campaign events, Francis repeats the story of his upbringing. He attended Raleigh Public Schools. He played point guard in high school. He swam in the Chavez Park pool. He spent weekends at the Hillsboro YMCA and summers at the Richard B. Harrison Library. His academic success propelled him to the Princeton, then Duke School of Law. Francis worked as a federal prosecutor in North Carolina. Before age 30, he served on Raleigh's Planning Commission. In 1993, he was appointed to fill a vacancy on the city council. He lost his election bid later that year. He started a law firm and later helped found North State Bank. In 1995, he became the general counsel for the Raleigh Housing Authority. Along the way, Francis became wealthy. Asked how much he's worth, Francis replies, "That's none of the public's damn business." But as Francis thrived, Southeast Raleigh grew frustrated. Gentrification was taking root, and historically black neighborhoods were being razed in redevelopment. African Americans felt unrepresented and overlooked. By 2016, Francis said he'd grown frustrated, too. One night, Francis recalls, he was talking to his 17-year-old son, Chase, playing Hamlet, as he put it, about the idea of running for mayor. "Should I? Should I not?" "Dad, I think you should," Chase said. "Why?" Francis replied. "Because I would think you would want to have a legacy behind us, a broader legacy in the community," Chase said. Francis thought the city needed new leadership, but his selfish reason for running, he admits, is that when I'm old, I want a part of my body of work to be in public service. Charles and Vivian Irving had been inducted into the Raleigh Hall of Fame in 2006, alongside Senator Jesse Helms. One day, perhaps, Mayor Francis could join them. Part 3. Man in a Fancy Suit. Growing up, Francis got used to winning elections. He became student body president in 5th grade, then again in the 9th and 12th grades. In high school, he was elected lieutenant governor of Boys Nation, an American Legion youth program. His friend, Brent Wood, was governor. The two stayed close. Both became lawyers. After Francis's failed run for the city council, Francis joined Wood's firm, which became Wood and Francis. They saw themselves as fighting the system. "We have a bit of the quality of the rock thrower in us," Francis told the Triangle Business Journal in 1998. "We often find ourselves on the outside scaling the walls of the castle." In 1994, a man named Stan Van Etten hired the firm to represent International Heritage Incorporated, his multi-level marketing company, which sold luxury goods. In 1997, Francis became the company's lobbyist. A year later, Van Etten pyramid scheme unraveled. With state and federal regulators bearing down, International Heritage went bankrupt. A 60 Minutes investigation dubbed Van Etten one of the biggest con men of all time for defending investors by defrauding investors out of millions. In 2005, Van Etten pleaded guilty to fraud and was sentenced to 10 years in prison. After becoming a prison informant, he was granted early release in 2012. Wood, meanwhile, was disbarred in 2006 after being convicted by a federal jury of wire fraud, mail fraud, and money laundering, one of at least 10 former Van Etten associates to have pleaded guilty or been found guilty of charges related to International Holdings. Francis was not among them. "I certainly wasn't aware of any criminal activity," he said. The law practice dissolved in 2000, years before Wood and Van Etten were convicted. Francis points out, but after International Holdings dissolved and the 60 Minutes expose, Francis said he and Wood remained friends. Wood donated $250 to Francis' campaign, the records show. All the while, Francis was general counsel for the Raleigh Housing Authority, a position he still holds. He has argued that his work there gives him insight into the city's affordable housing crisis. His tenure began with tragedy. A carbon monoxide leak killed a mother and son in Walnut Terrace. The RHA sacked its director and the attorney and hired Francis in 1995. The agency has come under scrutiny during Francis's time. In 2006, a federal judge ruled that the RHA revoked a Section 8 voucher without giving the tenant a proper hearing. In 2014, WNCN reported that the RHA had awarded Section 8 vouchers to families making more than the median income. That same year, the State Labor Department fined the RHA for failing to tell employees they were working in asbestos-filled buildings. It then came to light that the RHA's director, Steve Beam, was earning a $280,000 salary while taking a month off a year to pursue a side gig as a magician. Beam subsequently retired. As general counsel, Francis reviewed Beam's contract, but he didn't set its terms. Still, he thinks Beam may have been worth it. "He's well compensated," Francis said, "but in general, I think that top performers in government are often undercompensated. We would get better service from our top people if you paid them well and then held them to account." Last year, the Indy reported that the RHA is facing a declining number of landlords willing to accept Section 8 vouchers, which has contributed to a 3 to 7 year housing assistance waiting list. Some landlords accuse the agency of being a bureaucratic nightmare. As the RHA's lawyer, Francis, isn't responsible for its policy decision, that's up to the board of directors, which is appointed by the city council. But he does carry out the agency's convictions. And in 2002, when Tyrone Horton's guardian ad litem sued the RHA on the 10-year-old's behalf, arguing that the RHA had struck him and his family in a housing unit with lead-based paint, which led to lead poisoning and severe injuries, it was Francis's job to defend the RHA. He did, successfully. In 2004, Francis convinced the state Supreme Court that the RHA was protected by sovereign immunity, the doctrine that says governments can only be sued to the extent that they have insurance covering that type of lawsuit. The RHA's insurance policy specifically excluded lead-based claims, according to the ruling. If Francis wins, he'll likely have to give up the RHA gig, which he bills at $150 an hour, less than half his usual rate, he notes. Just before 5 o'clock on a September morning in 2008, Matt Moore discovered water dripping from a light fixture on the ceiling of his first floor East Davie Street condo. He laid down towels to contain the spill. Then he walked upstairs and knocked on the door. No one answered in that apartment. The leak continued. A few hours later, Moore was using buckets to catch the water. He asked the condo's homeowners association for help. The HOA told him that the condo upstairs belonged to Charles Francis, who rented it out. Moore called. An assistant from Francis' law firm showed up later that morning and found that the source of the leak was a faulty water heater. Then Moore wrote an account of the incident on social media, the assistant handing him a document to sign stating that Francis wasn't responsible for any damages, with a handwritten addendum that added, "to the extent not covered by the insurance of the Homeowners Association." Moore confirmed this account to the Indy. By that afternoon, the water had finally stopped dripping. A team from the HOA tore out a section of the ceiling. Later, they returned to pull up the hardwood floors in the multiple rooms, remove drywall and insulation, and install industrial fans to dry out the condo. Eventually, Francis, whom Moore described as a man in a fancy suit, stopped by. "I know immediately by his posture and his words that I am an inconvenience," Moore wrote. "I'm just paperwork and phone calls that weren't on his docket. Nor were they billable. I have never had a first impression stench from someone quite that strong. He doesn't even budge in offering help, apology, or cooperation." Moore's apartment needed about $15,000 worth of repair, which were covered by insurance with a $3,000 deductible. The HOA tried to recoup the funds from Francis, but Moore later learned that Francis's unit was uninsured and that attempts to collect the date were unsuccessful. Believing that challenging a millionaire trial attorney in court would unlikely go in his favor, Moore should shoulder the cost himself. "He was an absentee landlord who protected his own butt," Moore wrote. "He didn't care about the property he owned." Francis denies that he was negligent in any way. "We didn't pay for the damage down below because it wasn't something that was our fault or that we were obliged to do," he said. "I'm not in business to give away money, and I don't do that in this case." Francis still owns the condo, which he purchased in 1991 for $76,500. It's now worth three times that. According to property records, he also owns his Birmingham Wood Mansion and a more modest home next door, as well as two smaller homes near Meredith College. His mother, Florence Irving Francis, owns 12 properties in Raleigh, according to Wake County records. She inherited most of them from Charles Irving Sr., or her sister Vivian. The rest she secured through loans from North State Bank. Several of those properties contain nice, well-kept homes. Others are older dwellings in low-income neighborhoods or vacant, overgrown lots. The city has issued three of the properties a total of four code violations since 2018, all of which were resolved within 2 weeks. Two properties have been deemed unfit for human habitation. They were repaired and brought up to code. Francis's family has also reaped the benefits of Southeast Raleigh's gentrification. Property records show that Florence Francis has sold several properties that were later flipped, including some to developer Jason Queen, who specializes in historic renovations. Francis said he shouldn't be faulted for what his relatives do, and he doesn't manage his mother's properties. My mother, at the young age of 94, is quite capable of managing her own affairs, he said. She has a memory that is better than most 40-year-olds and is fully in charge of her own business. He adds, you can't hold me responsible for a decision that was made by a family member in terms of the sale of a property or whatever the criticism may be. I don't own any properties that I wouldn't live in myself. Period. Geraldine Ashamy believed in Francis. In 2017, she was one of many volunteers working for his campaign. She knocked on doors throughout Southeast Raleigh and registered people to vote. She thought Nancy McFarland hadn't done enough to combat gentrification or help the city's homeless. I worked on his campaign like a Hebrew slave, she said. I really believe that he was really about all the people in East Raleigh, all the people. He said all the right things. Francis made his presence known in Southeast Raleigh in 2017. But after he lost, Ashamy says, he disappeared. For 6 months, she says, she tried to get in touch, but he never took her calls. Finally, she got the message. To me, he made a lot of promises. I can't say what he did for anybody else. Ashamy says, I will not support you. If one vote would be a reason you don't get in, and that would be my vote, you won't get in. Charles may have become preoccupied with some other things after the 2017 election, and that may or may not be part of the issues that people are contemplating on whether they are supporting him or not, says Danny Coleman, who chairs the South Central Citizens Advisory Council. It's been up to him to explain that away. Joshua Bishop L., a community activist who chairs Justice Served NC, is still backing Francis, who says he is the only candidate who understands the issues facing Southeast Raleigh. He's basically the example of the American dream for the African American, Bishop L. said. Some people try to look for the flaws or look where they can assassinate a person's characteristics. It wasn't easy getting to the position he's in now. It was hard work. And the hard work is paying off. Part 4, the role of leadership. 2 weeks before the 2017 runoff, Francis met with the Triangle Urban Republicans, pitching himself as a bridge builder, willing to work across party lines. Amid the fury over President Trump's then-recent remarks about the white supremacists in Charlottesville, and the Durham protesters who had toppled a downtown monument to the boys who wore the gray, he told the mostly white audience that there is too much shouting across town squares over the Confederate memorials. Instead of shouting, he said, I'm going to listen to what you think and try to come to a solution and not focus on ideology. Asked about that quote, Francis said, he was obviously not making a point in support of Confederate memorials. Rather, he was trying to show them that he could work across the aisle, he said. Dredging up old quotes is a distraction, he said, pivoting to a familiar refrain. What's far more important than whether we have a Confederate memorial up or not is who owns the property in Raleigh? Who has the job opportunities in Raleigh? Who has business opportunities in Raleigh? Who has housing opportunities in Raleigh? In April, a Raleigh police officer shot and killed Sohail Morad, a man with a history of mental illness. The officer had turned off his body camera. According to the Raleigh Police Department, Morad grabbed a folding knife from his pocket, crouched in an aggressive stance, and approached the officer while screaming profanities. The officer shot him 8 times. Majerad's death renewed calls for a civilian oversight board. For years, city council has dragged its feet on the issue, largely because creating a board with subpoena and disciplinary powers would require changing state law. In June, Francis appeared to suggest that the city push do just that. In an interview with the Indy, he said, a civilian oversight board was overdue. It's not acceptable to say that because it hasn't been before, we're not going to do it, he said. Sometimes a role in leadership is to go to the General Assembly and work with them to get changes in state law so we can move where we need to go. Months later, the ACLU sent candidates a questionnaire asking if they would support a police oversight board. Francis said yes, adding, I am the first mayoral candidate to call for it, and I believe that the city council and the activist group Police Accountability Community Task Force should actively work together. But in a survey from the News and Observer, Francis gave a different answer. He told a paper that the community must continue to work in tandem with the police department, as opposed to merely overseeing its actions. Confused, the ACLU asked Francis for clarification. On September 14th, Francis, who has received the endorsement of the Raleigh Police Protective Association, submitted a new answer to the ACLU, this time saying that while he favored a review board, he didn't think it should have subpoena powers. Francis's response to the Indies questionnaire submitted on September 17th had the same answer. Asked about his apparent change of mind, Francis said, he's received about 25 surveys during the campaign and hasn't had time to complete them all, and he farmed them out. Not the Indy, he promises. Honestly, I haven't even read the ACLU questionnaire you're talking about. Just some staff person did that, Francis said. Francis said he never changed his position, and it's misleading to the extreme to suggest that he did so. It is just as false to leave the impression that I ever intended to say that I was for the subpoena power, he says. On August 22nd, at a mayoral forum hosted by real estate developers from the NAIOP, Francis said that he hadn't come to a final decision on whether the city should join the Umsted Coalition lawsuit to stop RDU's quarry lease. 3 days later, Francis attended a screening of the anti-quarry documentary, 400 Feet Down at the Rialto Theater, alongside members of the Umsted Coalition and the four council incumbents who have made the lease a focal point of their campaigns. There, Francis gave a similar speech to the one he gave at the NAIOP forum, except now he'd reached his decision. He would be the fifth vote to join the lawsuit. His announcement was met with a standing ovation. Asked what changed in those 3 days, Francis is candid, nothing. Why are you going to shoot your best shot in the practice, he explains. You shoot your best shot in the game. The Rialto was the game. Francis' opposition to the quarry won him the backing of some environmental advocates. But from 1993 to 2001, he worked as a lobbyist for Alcoa, an aluminum manufacturing company that had a smelting plant in Baden, a small town about 40 miles northeast of Charlotte. The plant closed in 2007 and was partially demolished in 2010. For 60 years until the late 70s, Alcoa used the town's unlined dump for its aluminum waste. Environmentalists have argued that toxins from the aluminum have leaked into the nearby water supplies. A creek near the landfill, for instance, was found to contain cyanide, which fluoride, cyanide, and other toxins were discovered in nearby wetlands. Areas around the smelting plant tested positive for PCBs, a heavy toxic chemical group banned since 1979, and the carcinogenic solvent TCE. In the area around the plant, people were dying of cancers that attorney Mona Wallace believed were connected to Alcoa's pollution. Colon, lung, stomach, brain, kidney, blood, esophagus, pancreas, bladder, throat, skin, tongue, some in conjunction with each other. Wallace, a partner at the North Carolina firm Wallace Graham, which also has brought a series of high-profile lawsuits against the hog industry, filed hundreds of complaints against Alcoa, but her clients often died before she could reach a settlement. This, according to a 2016 report from Energy and Environmental News. Alcoa has denied any wrongdoing. According to E&E News, in 1992, the year before Francis became an Alcoa lobbyist, Alcoa sued its insurers for the cost of pollution damage and the remediation at dozens of its facilities across the country. It singled out its three smelting plants and included Baden for high coal cleanup costs, more than $50 million each. The other two smelting plants have since been declared Superfund sites. Baden was not. Francis points out that he hasn't been the company's lobbyist in nearly two decades. He says most of his work for Alcoa involved helping a subsidiary called Yadkin Incorporated in its stewardship of the water and land and representing the company to legislators and state officials. "I'm proud of the work I did in helping the company to be a steward of the water and land," Francis said. "But of course, that representation does not mean that I had any involvement or influence over everything that the company did or even all of its legal matters beyond the scope of my work for them." "This, too, is a distraction," Francis argues. "In writing your story," he cautions, "try to avoid false parallels and mislead more than inform in an effort to support a thesis." Part 5. Indomitable. "You have to make hay while the sun is shining," Charles Irving Sr. often told his grandson. Irving went to work at the printing press every day until his 97th birthday. He died in his sleep exactly 1 year later. Francis inherited his grandfather's habits. He often works from "can't see in the morning" to "can't see at night." He's driven even in his hobbies. He runs 3 miles a day, several days a week. He goes to the Y and lifts weights. He plays squash, smashing the ball against a wall until his opponent can't return his serve. Charles Francis goes after what he wants, and he usually gets it. When he doesn't, he tries again. That's another lesson he learned from his grandfather. He was indomitable, Francis said. He would not give up. When there was business or family or something personal, he would not be defeated. Until the end, Francis never got roiled. Every question elicited a swift, confident, yet dispassionate answer. "When you step out into the arena, you expect that you're going to get bloodied," he said 2 weeks ago. "I've lived my life in a way that I'm proud of my accomplishments as a lawyer. I'm proud of my accomplishments in business, and I don't have things to apologize for or to be shamed about." Then on September 26th, the News and Observer endorsed Marianne Baldwin, a week after the Indy had done so. To Francis, this was a signal that the powers that be weren't going to give him a fair shake. And in a final interview for this story, a last round of questions about Alcoa, about his mother's Southeast Raleigh's properties, and the N and O's endorsement, he finally sounded upset, even mad. "The N&O's intellectually lazy endorsement refused to deal with the nuance of my positions," he said. "The consensus-established opinion of certain Democratic electeds doesn't want change because the status quo is to their benefit. The rationale of my campaign is that too many people have been left out of that consensus. To hell with them all." Like Charles Irving Sr., Francis sees himself as indomitable. His confidence is palpable. This time around, he believes victory is inevitable. With a strong enough turnout, he adds, he might even win an outright majority on Tuesday. "And one way or another," he predicted, "I am going to be the next mayor of Raleigh." Our next item, the Indy's Voting Guide for October of 2019. The Indy's endorsements in Raleigh: Mayor Marianne Baldwin. City Council at Large: Nicole Stewart, Jonathan Melton. District A: Patrick Bufkin. District B: Brian Fitzsimmons. District C: Corey Branch. District D: Sage Martin. And District E, David Knight. In Durham, City Council at Large, Javiera Caballero, Jillian Johnson, and Charlie Reese. Early voting runs through October 4th. Voting locations in Raleigh, the Wake County Board of Elections, 337 South Salisbury Street, Glen Eden Pilot Park, Neighborhood Center, 1500 Glen Eden Drive. Method Road Community Center, 514 Method Road. Green Road Community Center, 4201 Green Road. The Millbrook Exchange Community Center, 1905 Spring Forest Road. And Roberts Park Community Center, 130 East Martin Street. Durham locations. Durham County Board of Elections, 201 North Roxborough Street. Criminal Justice Resources Center, 326 East Main Street. South Regional Library, 4505 South Alston Avenue. NCCU Turner Law Building, 640 Nelson Street. And the North Regional Library, 221 Milton Road. And now from the news section, Up in Smoke. Hemp could provide an off-ramp to struggling tobacco farms if the legislature doesn't get in the way. Christopher Gupton, a 31-year-old Appalachian State University student, co-owns High Country Herbs, a hemp farm in Caldwell County, with his wife, Heather Bryant. Until last year, they could only grow hemp as part of a research pilot program through ASU. It wasn't very profitable. Then Congress passed the Farm Bill, and everything changed. In 1970, the U.S. government banned hemp production because it's in the same family as marijuana. But the 2018 Farm Bill reclassified the plant as an agricultural commodity, permitted wide-scale cultivation, and allowed the sale of hemp-derived products across state lines. Though hemp doesn't have enough THC to get you high, an increasingly popular variety does contain CBD, which is said to help with anxiety, insomnia, chronic pain, and other conditions. Gupton and Bryan expanded their output with three climate-controlled greenhouses and then expect to make as much as $98,000 per year from the 3 acres of smokable hemp plants. "This is a legit industry now in America," he said. "Let's try to make some money and put it to good use." In 2017, before the Farm Bill, the U.S. hemp market was valued at $820 million, according to the Hemp Business Journal. The research firm Brighton Group projects that the American CBD industry could reach $20 billion by 2022. There are now 1,324 licensed industrial hemp farmers in North Carolina, according to the North Carolina Department of Agriculture. Hemp is a resilient plant that requires little water and few pesticides. And because the plants are so compatible, it could offer an off-ramp to tobacco farmers reeling from both steadily declining consumption and President Trump's trade war. In 2017, North Carolina farmers exported $162 million in tobacco to China, the state's biggest tobacco consumer. By 2018, that had fallen to $4 million. In 2019, after China banned U.S. agricultural imports, it will likely be zero. "I have never seen anything as exciting to the farmer as this advent of hemp," says Larry Wooten, president of the North Carolina Farm Bureau. But even as the state embraces this burgeoning industry, lawmakers' lingering fears about marijuana might get in the way. Earlier this year, the General Assembly took up the North Carolina Farm Act, or Senate Bill 315, which, among other things, would give the state's hemp industry a regulatory framework, turning a pilot program into a state agency, setting licensing guidelines, and requiring hemp farmers to be licensed. But it comes with a catch. SB 315 classifies smokable hemp the kind Gumpton says planted, as marijuana and bans it. That's a big problem for farmers, says Marty Clemens, president of the North Carolina Industrial Hemp Association. Smokable hemp is a high-value element of the global CBD industry. Lawmakers, she adds, are absolutely terrified that all cannabis is going to become legal in this country, as it has recreationally in 11 states and Washington, D.C., and medicinally in 22 more, but not North Carolina. That's not lawmakers' official rationale. Instead, as the State Bureau of Investigation explained in a memo this spring, it's that hemp flowers and marijuana look and smell alike, and there's no field test to tell which is whist. If law enforcement can't tell the difference, that defeats the previous basis for probable cause to seize items believed to be marijuana. If smoking hemp is legal, it won't be possible to enforce laws against marijuana, said Eddie Caldwell, executive vice president and general counsel of the North Carolina Sheriff's Association. And when officers search for marijuana, they often come across harder drugs. If smokable hemp is legal, it will prevent them from coming across these other drugs because they won't have probable cause to search the car, Caldwell says. Drug dealers will be able to use smokable hemp as a cover. If they get pulled over or the dogs are alerted, they can say it was just smokable hemp. Susanna Birdstrong, senior policy counsel for the state ACLU, counters that classifying hemp as an illegal drug will only add to problems of mass incarceration and the over-policing of black and brown communities. North Carolina isn't the only state grappling with this question, and it wouldn't be the first to ban smokable hemp. Indiana is among several that have. But on September 13th, a federal judge issued an injunction striking down that ban after industry groups filed a lawsuit arguing that the federal farm bill preempted the state's law. If North Carolina's smokable hemp ban becomes law, a lawsuit here is sure to follow, Clemens said. The Indiana ruling effectively rendered North Carolina's debate moot. Senate Bill 315, lead sponsor Senator Jackson, said that in a press release last week, and the General Assembly should have moved on. It's my belief that this judicial order has made clear that Congress and President Trump had every intention of legalizing all hemp products, including smokable hemp, throughout the United States. The Senate and House have gone back and forth on where the ban should go into effect and when. Under the state's version of SB 315, it would start in December 2020 to give hemp farmers time to sell their existing supplies. The House originally wanted it to go into effect this December, but then settled on a compromise date of May 1, 2020, in the version it passed in August. SB 315 is now back in the Senate, where it has been referred to the Rules Committee. The next news article, aftermath. In the wake of a controversial racial discrimination investigation, Orange County Schools settled a retaliation claim made by the investigator. In September, Orange County Schools settled two federal complaints filed by a senior district official over claims of discrimination and retaliation. According to a settlement agreement obtained by the Indy, Chief Communications Officer Seth Stevens filed a Title VI complaint with U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights against OCS on April the 29th, alleging that he had been subjected to retaliation. Months earlier, Stevens, who is black, had filed a separate discrimination complaint against the Board of Education with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. The circumstances behind the EEOC complaint are unclear, but OCS Interim Superintendent Randy Bridges confirmed that the retaliation complaint stemmed from the aftermath of an investigation Stevens conducted into allegations of racial discrimination made by the parent of a first grader at Cameron Park Elementary School. In both cases, records requests that might shed light on why Stevens felt slighted have not yet been fulfilled. Stevens declined to comment on the settlement, saying, "I hope that the focus is on the students and starting the school year on the right track." In a closed session on September 9th, the school board approved the settlement, placing Stevens on paid administrative leave until his resignation became effective on January 31st, 2020. This, according to the agreement. His contract had been set to expire in 2022. Stevens' salary is $98,549.40, according to Bridges. Under the agreement, he will be paid about $41,000. In return, Stevens, who has worked at OCS since 2012, agreed to withdraw his complaints as well as another grievance he had filed at an unspecified time, according to the settlement. Stevens' mother, Brenda Stevens, is a school board member. She recused herself from the vote on her son's settlement. Bridges said in a 4-3 vote in May, the board removed her as chair shortly before her time in that role was set to end, citing in part a perceived conflict over her son's involvement in the Cameron Park investigation. As the Indy first reported, Stevens completed his investigation into the Cameron Park matter on March 8th. His report upheld complaints of harassment and racial intimidation made in February by parent Crystal Little against the staffers of the school, which his report noted had no black teachers. According to Stevens' report, he looked into the matter because neither the chief human resource officer nor the superintendent was in the office, though they would usually be in the ones to handle such complaints. The school board evidently wasn't satisfied with his investigation. In April, OCS had its chief human resources officer conduct a second investigation. Asked at the time whether that was standard practice, then outgoing superintendent Todd Wirt replied, "It depends on the situation." Then in early May, OCS initiated a third investigation. It hired Brian Martin, most recently the senior district for employee relations for the Wake County Public School System, and he was meant to review the Little case, according to his contract with the district. He was paid $5,000, or $100 an hour, for 50 hours of work through June 10th. But even that wasn't enough. On June 10th, the school board hired Brooks Pierce, a law firm with locations in Raleigh, Greensboro, and Wilmington, to conduct a comprehensive independent review of the parents' complaint at Cameron Park, including all aspects of both the parents' complaint and the administrative review of the complaint. Chairman Will Atherton told the Indy in an email, "The board authorized OCS to pay Brooks Pierce attorney Shauna Fulton $310 per hour and her paralegal $195 an hour, up to $25,000. According to Brooks Pierce's website, Fulton specializes in representing entities facing white-collar criminal prosecution and government investigations, and has represented public officials in investigations and administrative hearings, defending them against alleged government ethics violations. On August 26, 2 weeks before approving the settlement with Stevens, the board voted to amend OCS's contract with Brooks Pierce to authorize paying the firm an additional $25,000. It's unclear where the school district's inquiry into Litt's complaint stands or why the district appears to have signed off on spending more than $50,000 on three additional investigations into what happened at Cameron Park. Little removed her child from the school and the school district in March. In June, as a part of its efforts to ease racial tensions and reduce a gaping achievement gap, OCS hired its first chief deputy director, Dina Keeling. The school district also named Bridges, the district's interim superintendent, replacing Wirt. Both started on July 1st. We turn now to the indie music section, Cradle of Time. The Internet's two-decade nostalgia cycle comes to life at the Cradle this week. Yay! Hey, remember the late 1990s when rock was rap, and was pop, and teen song and dance acts reigned, selling music on plastic discs that cost $1,000? Well, All-Star and the Internet were both just fads, not eternal, all-consuming scourges. When the nation was seized by the mass delusion that American Beauty was a good movie, even if you weren't born yet in those heady days, you probably feel like you remember them if you frequent pop culture websites, which just wrapped a positively orgiastic summer of 1999 nostalgia. Roughly two decades later has long been this nostalgia cycle's sweet spot. In the O's, O-hundreds, VHI debuted I Love the 80s. In the 80s, the Wonder Years enshrined the 60s, as happy days had done in the jaded 70s for the innocent 50s, a time when people were probably pining for, I don't know, phosphate sodas and the telegraph and rolling hoops with sticks. But online culture media has both cemented and weaponized 20 years as a magic number, and the retrospective format is a reliable clickstorm across every vertical. Of course, I read them all, and pitch some of them, with candy rush relish and also with a certain gnawing unease as a sense of temporal monotony sets in. Can you imagine what it's going to be like next summer when the Y2K thing pieces hit? All the space that will go to Santana and Rob Thomas's smooth instead of, you know, good new art? Perhaps it's because there's nothing new under the sun, that everything old sends us over the moon. In this, as in most aspects, the late 20th century thing is called indie rock mirrors, the pop landscape it was sold as being set against. This week at Cat's Cradle, two bands are playing modest 90s indie music in their entirety, with Built to Spill performing 1997 Keep It Like a Secret. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The previous program was designed for a print-impaired audience. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.